You are listening to Faithless Brewing, a Magic the Gathering podcast for the Spike Rogue. Each week, we design spicy new decks geared at tournament play. We put our creations to the test in competitive leagues and share our findings on the air. Coming up this week on the Roundup, a brewer's guide to the Hogak metagame, which decks can compete and why they should play more Smiting Helix. Plus, fair and balanced spoiler hype for Core Set 2020 and a tournament report from Magic Fest Seattle featuring an undefeated Day 2 performance in the Grand Prix. After that, on the flashback, we divulge the secrets of the ninja, authoritative ninja power rankings, and our verdict on Ice Fang Quaddle in mid-range and tempo shells. Finally, on the brew session, three new builds with Force of Virtue. Can a free crusade revitalize the goat archetype, or is this card too bad for modern play? All of that and more on this edition of Faithless Brewing. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Welcome to episode 9 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. I am David Robertson, joined as always by Dan Schriever. He is Cave Dan on Magic Online. How's it going, Dan?
I'm doing great, Dave. How are you?
I'm hanging in there. It's finally summertime in Minneapolis, so, you know, all the beautiful people are running around with no clothes off, trying to pretend like winter isn't 2 months away.
I miss Minneapolis in the summer times. It's been a rainy start to the season here in Connecticut, but I think we finally turned the corner. It's been really nice the past couple of weeks.
Also joining us is Damon Alexander, fresh off of a day two at GP Seattle. How are things in the hometown, Damon?
Oh, they're great. Just, you know, enjoying Seattle. It is also summer here. The sun is out for so long every day, and I enjoyed most of that by spending it indoors over the weekend.
Wait, I mean, Modern Horizons, you can't stay away. It's got you hooked.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that set is a blast for Limited. If you guys haven't done a draft with it, I highly recommend it to anybody who's listening.
Is your impression of draft colored by the fact that you went undefeated on day two in the draft portion of GP Seattle?
Well, it certainly can be more fun to win than to lose a lot of the time.
Yeah, I would agree.
Believe it or not, I'm actually undefeated in Modern Horizons drafts, although that's probably because I've only done four of them total. Well, I had a TurboTown draft where we drew to try to make the next draft as I was getting crushed in game two. But
hang on a sec. Isn't TurboTown a one-round draft?
Yeah.
So you went 0-0 and a draw in the Turbo Town.
The drafting is frequently the most fun part. They announced last call for the last Turbo Town of the night, or Turbo Draft of the night, and I was like, oh, that kind of sounds more fun than not.
One of my ideas for trying to make the Pro Tour more accessible, as Streamers heard this before, is they should just have everyone draft and then have like a team of draft experts just decide like what record the deck would get out of three. And then you don't have to show any actual limited gameplay, which is often the least watched of any of the Pro Tour. But you just, so you still get the aspect of drafting. People see all that. And then you just like, you know, whatever, Ben Stark, Martin Yuza, pick your other five guys or gals. They just say, all right, that's a 2-1. And then you're just done. Then you go draft again. And then so you get your record that way. And then you just go to standard or modern or whatever.
And they do the same thing there with the deck list.
Yeah, then you show that to Josh Hunter Layton and whoever else. And, yeah, there's no real reason to even play.
It's just like gymnastics.
The Russian judge.
Certainly a well-known way of handling competitive sports. How could it go wrong here?
Yeah. Mary Lou Rutten, no questions asked.
Amazing.
So do you want to give us some highlights from your GP, Damon?
Yeah, so I played four straight days of Modern Horizons. Still a little mentally in a fog from that, so forgive me if I sound like a crazy person. I played the MTQ Modern Horizons Sealed on Thursday, went 3-2, and then we drew the last round. I played Day 1A on Friday. I went 4-4, featuring a bye, so 3-4. Highlight there was I got to play against Dana Fisher, who was just adorable. If you guys don't know her, she's, a 9-year-old who is a very precocious young Magic player, and she does very well in some GPs. It's quite impressive. And again, just completely sweet and adorable. We chatted a bit, and I was like, would you play in Modern? She's like, oh yeah, Elves and Dredge. I was like, oh, why not Hogak? She's like, I hate Hogak.
All right, well, yeah. So, the next generation is going to save us, is what I'm hearing.
Exactly.
I believe Dana Fisher is the youngest player to ever make day two at a GP that we know of so far.
And I think it's her stated goal to try to be the youngest player to top eight. I don't know what the age number is that she's racing against, but that would be super cool.
Yeah.
The youngest world champion was Julian Newton. I want to say he was 16 or maybe even younger than that.
Wow.
But she's still got time.
Yeah.
If you're listening, Dana Fisher, we believe
yeah,
in
we
you.
Still, yeah, I mean, I've got a lot of money invested.
We have a lot of deck ideas for you to try out also along the way. But yeah, then I went to day 1B, you know, feeling a little bit down about my results, but I managed to get a deck with some awesome cards like Thundering Djinn and Lesser Masticore. So perhaps not the best sealed deck in the world, but it was a pretty you know, cohesive blue-red deck. And I had two losses. I fell to 3-2, losing to Winds of Abandon one round in game one. And then game three, I lost to Winds of Abandon. That card is kind of tough to play around. And then the next round, I lost to Soul Herder and Urza. They just kind of went nuts. It was insane. Managed to squeeze it out, 6-3. Went into day two for draft and managed to go 3-0 in the first round, featuring a blue-white deck, which had some strong opening plays like turn three Mana War, bounce your dude, turn four Irregular Cohort, make a dude, turn five Settle your guy, and then either Flicker the Mana War or the Irregular Cohort and just kind of seal the deal from there. Draft two, managed to draft a four-color Snow Trainwreck. The deck was not that good. But somehow I managed to play against Black-Red, which was a terrible matchup to begin with, and my opponent just handed me some wins by flooding out massively, massively, massively. Then my last opponent was a pairings standings genius, and was like, if we ID, we actually do better than if we play. We both get the max payout if we draw, and only one of us does if we ID. And so thanks, Eric. I wish I had your skill at this sort of assessment. Yeah, so I finished in 50th place, my best GP finish by far.
That's amazing. That's really awesome. And this was a huge Grand Prix.
Yeah, it's interesting because there was two day ones, and so it's like I heard around 15 or 70 unique players between the 2 days, but then each day had about over 1,000 people in them, and so it functioned more like a 2,000-person GP or maybe like 1,800-person GP. There were almost 400 people in day two.
Yeah. And I understand you came away with a very prized possession as a direct result of your performance.
Yeah, so one thing that happens on day two of a GP is packs are all stamped to help avoid fraud. It's interesting because if you value the stamps, which is, you know, they're good souvenirs. If you pick up a sweet card a day two of a GP, you get the stamp. You remember, man, I didn't just buy this card off eBay. I earned this card. And pack two, pick one, staring at me was of draft two was a Force of Negation with a panda stamp. The best part of drafting is balancing the... Like the dream is to build a deck that not only can 3-0, but you also, you know, judiciously rare draft along the way and then come away with some sweet rares. And this is a thing that I remember trying to master back in high school with Dan. It was not just about winning the draft, but winning the draft in style with a couple cool rares.
I still practice what I preach.
Exactly. I think my deck should have had two Savage Swipes and a Snowland, and it didn't have those as a result. But again, if the red-black players flood out, then you can beat them with anything, maybe.
So as you're looking at this Force of Negation with a panda stamp on it, is there any consideration going through your head that maybe if you pass this one, you'll get a Force of Negation next pick with a better stamp on it? Telephone stamp or star?
Well, so first off, the stamps are the same for all of pack two. So I'd have to wait till pack three for a chance at a better stamp. Second, it turns out that like the judges all have to stamp the cards. Like I don't know if they do it the night before or whatever, but when they stamp them, they don't all stamp them equally. Some of them get like a nice firm stamp. Some of them get like a firm but smudgy stamp. Some of them get like a faint stamp. This one had a firm but smudgy panda stamp, so it's already doing pretty well. And then honestly, a panda stamp is about as cool as I've ever seen on these cards. But some of them are just like, you know, one of them's like an Easter egg stamp, and it just looked kind of weird. Panda stamp is about as good as they get in my experience.
A firm but smudgy panda. Is there anything better than that?
And I learned this lesson the hard way by not taking a stamped Bitter Blossom at GP Vancouver, which would have also been a sweet, sweet card to own. And I was like, I'm going to do really well this draft because I'm not rare drafting. I went 0-3. So I learned the lesson that there's a lot of variance in Magic, it comes down to. And so you can draft a card that's really good, and then you literally over three rounds never even see it. And so sometimes you just, you know, make your deck a little bit worse and it doesn't matter at all. Or you make your deck a little bit better and it doesn't matter at all. So... Of course, if I had a choice of a foil Tarmogoyf in a top eight draft, I would absolutely, absolutely not. I don't know.
I literally don't need the money, but I would just do it to show how ridiculous the payout structure is at Grand Prix.
those of you guys that are not familiar with this story, this actually happened at a GP some years ago. And I think I was actually a pro player that took it, and I got a lot of crap for it. It's just a funny story. I won't give him crap for that. I think it's funny. I think it's cool. but
Magic players kind of took it as a personal insult for some reason. What can you do?
So any other favorite memories from the GP weekend?
Yeah, I think my favorite memory was, so I went to round 8 at 5-2, which is basically makes it a win and make day 2, lose and you're out. And I was taking my blue-red pile against a blue-black deck. And I managed to win game 1. I think they kind of just flooded out, and he played like the Enchant Ninja card, and my deck had a couple Winter's Rests that line up well against enchantments that come back when the creature dies. And then game 2, I had like a lesser Mastercore, and like I was kind of ahead because I think we had faced a little counter war that I came out on top. And I resolved a Reign of Revelation to go up some cards, and his draw just wasn't that threatening. But he had one of those, the Fairies here, which we discussed on our podcast last week. And blue-black deck in the 5-2 bracket at a GP will frequently have a certain ninja we also discussed, Fallen Shinobi. And that card, you know, you can be up a couple of cards off your Reign of Revelation, but that card will bring you back in a hurry if things go right. So it's kind of on edge. I was like, man, if he attacks, I think I need to just spend my mana killing his Fairies here. But he held it back, and so I went end of turn Factor Fiction. And I deal with the 5 cards. I didn't really see actually too closely, but I saw it was 5 spells. My opponent riffles through the pile and is like, I don't want to deal with this. I concede. So that was how I made day 2 with the classic EOT FOFYL.
Yeah.
So it was very exciting. End of turn, Factor Fiction, you lose. It was the catchphrase back in Invasion Block.
That's amazing.
With Dr. Teeth, you wouldn't just get them to shuffle them up and head on to the next game.
If only that worked in Modern. Like, so many of my unsuccessful Modern brews are because I expect them to just concede in the face of all the cards I've drawn, but they won't do it.
Did you guys play any cards?
We did. There's all kinds of MTGO results for Modern, and I think the Reign of Hogak is here to stay at this point. I think at the MCQ, Dan, how many were there in the top 32?
I believe there were 7 in the top 32 at the MCQ online.
And that's like 400 players, 350, something like that.
Yeah, and I'm not sure what happened at the, there was an MCQ for Modern at GP Seattle, or Magic Fest Seattle, and I definitely saw some of my friends and some other people just getting hogacked. They didn't feel very happy about it.
Yeah, 7 out of 32 is... You know, it's under 25%, so not that great of a showing. That was at the MCQ. There was also a Modern Playoffs event, Magic Online, where Hogak took 8 out of the top 16 slots. So, I don't know. The truth is somewhere in between. Somewhere between 25 and 50% of the winner's meta right now is Hogak decks.
And then I think sometimes when we see paper tournaments, I would expect even more Hogak. I think the spikes, if you want to call them that, those people aren't really into just playing their brew or playing a style of deck that they like. They kind of move on to what they consider to be the best deck. So I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, a huge percentage of the top 8 was all Faithless Looting decks, you know, the UR Phoenix or the Hogak deck. I would expect to take, you know, 5 or 6 slots of a top 8 if we were going to play a paper Magic Grand Prix tomorrow. Magic Fest, my apologies.
Well, the main event is a Grand Prix still, I think. It's the whole event is the Magic Fest.
All right. I didn't even know that. So
pretty sure.
Obviously, we need to work on our marketing skills over at WotC.
Yeah. But one theory I've heard is that a lot of people don't buy into, haven't bought into Hogak yet because, first off, the cards still have just barely come out.
Yes, absolutely. It's only been in paper.
I have a GP stamped Hogak if any of you guys are interested. but I've heard that a lot of people don't buy into the deck immediately, especially because the cards are fresh, and also because I think a lot of people are perhaps reasonably worried that if you buy in, it might get banned in a matter of a month or so, or maybe even less. I forget when the next BNR announcement is.
I would be stunned if they didn't ban something from it. What that will be, I don't know if it'll be Altar or Bridge from Below or both.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, if they don't ban something from it, I'm planning to go to GP Minneapolis in August, and it's going to be kind of hard to justify not playing that deck.
Yes, I agree. I'm really hoping just for the... I mean, I live in Minneapolis, so obviously I'll be at that one. I might even be hosting Trevor before, if he decides to come out.
Oh, I booked my tickets. I booked my tickets.
All right. For the sake of playing the tournament, I'm really hoping Hogak is banned, or, you know, whatever. Not banned.
Yeah.
I think the deck is still somewhat playable depending on what card they ban from it, but I don't want to be dominant.
Somebody wrote they enjoyed playing Hogak because they have plenty of time to eat and drink between rounds, which is quite true, I'm sure.
Well, they're in an awkward spot in terms of banning because they've they've said twice in the last 2 months that they're not going to take any preemptive action. They were thinking of the London Mulligan being the problem. They didn't even mention, it just didn't occur to them apparently that Hogak was going to be a problem. They say, we will not take any preemptive bans. We're going to let players like sort it out themselves. And they would have to be beating a quick retreat on that to sort of change their tune and have a ban either before or after the Pro Tour.
But the Pro Tour's, there's no ban announcement before the Pro Tour?
Well, there is, but I mean, that would be going back on what they said. They said they were going to like let it play out.
It's playing out with, I mean, the reality is that Wizards is obviously not good at understanding like what Modern is or what cards in Modern do. And they've shown that like over and over again. So, I mean, one of the things that happens when companies are bad at stuff is they double down and don't want to admit that they're bad at things. This is true, not just for WotC. It's true for whatever, General Electric and 3M and everybody else. And I think if they don't ban anything, that's exactly what this would be, is sort of the classic like misunderstanding of what sunk cost is.
Well, so regardless of what happens with a ban, I mean, 8 out of 16 Hogak decks is not 16 out of 16. There were other decks doing well. I'm talking about the Magic Online results from this weekend again. Interestingly, I think they were almost all mid-range and control decks. Like, nobody bothered to try to race in the aggro, like an aggro strategy. And there was very little big mana either. And I'm kind of wondering why that's the case. Like, why was it these mid-range and control decks like Eldrazi Tron, Jund, won one of the events. A guy on blue-white actually finished second in both of these tournaments. Is it Phoenix was well-represented? There was Esper. And I'm wondering if it's because Hogak is just so good at doing what it does. Like, you can only really fight it if you have a game plan that's designed to just react for the first few turns. Like, all you were planning to do in the first few turns anyway was stop them. So if they're coming at you with graveyard stuff or creatures, doesn't really matter. You just try to stop them.
I do think that one of the things that Hogak has done is chase out all the big mana, so you don't have to plan for that anymore. Like, when you look at sideboards, you know, Modern, one of the hallmarks of Modern is what a wide and varied format it is. There's all kinds of different decks that come at you from all different angles. But all the linear decks can't really compete with Hogak, or most of them. So all you have to do if you're playing a control deck is kill creatures and attack the graveyard. And if you can build decks that can just do that, then you do have a chance. Obviously, you can't crush Hogak because it's 8 of the top 16. But you can compete with it, and there's no reason to play something like Wild Nacatl or something. I mean, it's just a joke. So yeah, like, Hogak kind of eliminates a lot of cards you'd need extra sideboard slots for if you're playing, you know, let's just say Esper or something like that.
Certainly, it's a better time to be playing a deck that is a linear deck that relies on the graveyard also. Just because there's so much anti-graveyard hanging around sideboards now. It used to be you could maybe run 4 pieces, maybe 3 if you're feeling aggressive. But now a lot of these top decks are running somewhere between 4 to 6 of like the premium anti-graveyard cards. You know, Relic of Progenitus is a card that you play as an anti-graveyard card. If you're like, you know, your graveyard's cool and all, but I might need to cantrip this and stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas like Rest in Peace is like, we need to stop your graveyard and like, we need to be serious about this. And like Ravenous Trap even more so. Like, we need to handle your graveyard at instant speed on turn 0. And onwards. Ravenous Trap is spiking in price, by the way. They were buy-listing it at $4 at the GP. if that's a sign of anything.
You are starting to see one or two pieces main. I've seen a lot of blue-white decks, you know, eschew multiple Snapcaster Mages and play Rest in Peace main. I've seen the Jund deck playing one or two now Spellbombs main, plus, as we've talked about, you know, Scavenging Ooze is a cool card, but it can't actually compete with, you know, hardcore graveyard decks, but it's a speed bump, maybe.
Scavenging Ooze, I would say, is actually, I wouldn't call it a speed bump, I'll call it the opposite. It's a closer card against graveyard decks.
Mm.
You need to have like a speed bump card like Ravenous Trap, and then ideally you follow it up with a closer card. Frequently a single card isn't enough. Surgical is also a speed bump card more than a closer.
So Dan, what would you assess the competitive state of Modern to be? We have, I think Hogak is the clear sort of best deck, and then the next tier, I mean, would you say like Blue-Red Phoenix and Blue-White Control? Or just, is it Phoenix by itself and its own kind of tier? And then a bunch of fair decks that try to sort of really help their matchup with graveyard decks in the sideboard.
Yeah, I think that we're in a weird place timing-wise where there haven't been any major tournaments except for these online tournaments. So the decks that I mentioned is performing well. These mid-ranger control decks like Phoenix, like Jund, like Blue-White, like Eldrazi Tron. I guess that is the surviving tier one right now, the ones who can survive in a Hogak meta. And any deck that needs to like curve out with creatures and also draw heat pieces is just not, it's not going to work right now. But That being said, like, if you're playing in Magic Online or even at your local shop, Friday Night Magic or something, this may have nothing to do with the meta you're going to face. And I think partly this is because of the merging, the integration of the two leagues on Magic Online. The Friendly and Competitive are now just a Modern League, which, you know, it's led to some interesting results. Like, if you just join a league right now, I expect to face Hogak maybe once, but then I expect to face four completely random decks. It's a weird experience compared to just joining a competitive league where you'd expect to face four tier one decks out of five rounds. Now I'm facing all kinds of wild stuff. It's like the Wild West. And I'm not sure if that's partly because people are in more of a brewing mood because of Modern Horizons, or if it's that, you know, this is what the Friendly League was always like, and now you're just mixed in with competitive and friendly, or there's just more people trying Modern. I think that the total number of players in the league is 1,500 right now, whereas before it was 500 in each of the leagues.
And you're not getting punished for going, you know, 2-3 with your speculative brew. You know, I mean, you didn't just light tickets on fire.
Exactly. You're not getting punished for having a perhaps ill-formed deck list, which is great for us. Also, you're not really getting rewarded.
No comment.
Yes, you're not really getting rewarded either for the 5-0 or the 4-1 like you used to be. Like, those used to pay out huge, and now they've lopped off a considerable amount. So I think there are fewer people out there who are just, like, incentivized to be grinding the best deck and grinding tickets percentage-wise. So it kind of, like, leaves us in this place where, you know, we don't have as much attention on Modern right now from, like, the grinder community or what's left of it anyway. And that will change soon. I think there are some SCG events coming up. There's the Modern Pro Tours coming up. But yeah, in the meantime, it's kind of like, well, where are we with Modern? We're kind of drifting as a format. And you see this even on, like, the Modern subreddit. Just today, this is a Tuesday, like, there was a sort of splintering of the subreddit. Someone said this sub is not competitive enough. There's too many casuals here. Like, we need a competitive Modern sub. So they launched something called Modern Spikes, and it got, I think, 2,000 people have joined already to be more, like, you know, serious. It's too hard to find information about, like, what's actually happening in competitive Modern. So I don't know. I mean, they're definitely, like, I understand what they're responding to. Does that resonate at all with your experiences?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I played a deck. It was like a normal white-blue taxes deck. And again, even white-blue taxes is kind of a little bit of a brew. And they played a equipment, which is, it's a one mana equipment. It equips for one and it gives +1/+1. But if the creature it's equipping transforms, it transforms and gives +3/+3. I never got to see what card in my opponent's deck triggered that ability, but I almost wanted to let them beat me in the games I was just absolutely crushing them in, just to find out. I mean, what a sweet card. I don't know if it was for Archangel Avacyn. I don't know what was going on. What was the other card you were thinking it might be for, Dan?
I couldn't think of anything. Honestly, the artifact is Neglected Heirloom. If you're out there listening,
yeah, Neglected Heirloom. Yeah, please text us if you're. I don't know what the chances are that this person listens to the pod, but I have to know. I've played this card in mini casual decks with the one in a black vampire that flips for the discard, so you can attack for 6 on turn 3. But that's not what this person was doing. So, yeah, I mean, some of these are lost in the sands of time. I just had to crush them with, you know, ninjas, and it was just game over. But maybe a greater opportunity was lost.
Such a weird equipment, because it actually becomes worse for Constructed once you flip it, because now the equip cost becomes 3. We do get like +3/+3, but now it's equip 3, which is just a lot. I don't know.
This card is probably the reason why they're really afraid to unban Stoneforge Mystic, honestly. I mean,
right.
Maybe.
It'd be in every deck.
It's just too good.
If it's a 5-card package, it just wins.
But, I mean, we're teasing, but I think, like, the spirit of Modern is sort of, I'm, like, experiencing it now firsthand. Like, there's just a lot of people out there who just want to play sweet decks and play sweet cards. And, like, I think the majority of Modern matches being played are being played at FNMs and on Magic Online. So, like, this is kind of, like, what Modern is right now, like, unless you're going to a big tournament. You can expect to face one Hogak deck and four completely random decks when you join a league.
Yeah, Modern is kind of like Commander was before WotC decided to actively support it, where it's basically just like the people's format, and they got to do what they wanted in it. And then when Wizards decided to design Commander cards, they just like ruined that format, and now they try to design stuff for Modern, but because there's been no major tournaments, it literally, like Dan says, is still the Wild Wild West. Like, Sheriff White Earp hasn't come and like shown everyone the two or three perfect versions of UR Phoenix and Hogak that everyone should be playing. you know, we're out there casting, you know, Mardu, Smiting Helix and Changeling Outcast and God knows what else.
I got to give a quick shout out to Smiting Helix. That card is amazing.
I told you.
You did tell me. And I was skeptical at first, but I've come to see the light, the dark smiting light. I played one more league this week just with a version of that Mardu Helix Bolas of Sigil deck that we were talking about a couple of weeks ago. And yeah, I went 4-1 again, which is what the same result I had the first time. The Sigil itself didn't do that much, but just the package of Smiting Helix, Lightning Helix, and I think I had Lingering Souls in there. I wanted to play Seasoned Pyromancer, but they were all sold out on Mana Trader, so I played Rick's Mighty Reveler instead, just because, and he was great. And honestly, Smiting Helix was the MVP of that archetype, and someone else had posted a 5-0 results with a Mardu build with 4 Smiting Helix as well, I think in one of the recent deck dumps. So if you're interested in Mardu, which a lot of people, I think a lot of people out there like that archetype, this card is really good, and it may, perhaps should be a staple in the deck going forward.
Yeah, the card is incredible. It just, a lot of times you need a lot of removal against these creature decks. You know, a couple pieces might not be enough. And Smiting Helix becomes 2 premium pieces of removal. It buys you a ton of time and card advantage along the way. The card is legit. I was actually facing, I played one round of the GP on Friday, and I was like, turn 2, Lesser Masticore, discard Lava Dart. And I was like, this is like a great line. This is Lesser Masticore is somehow the best card in my deck, so how can I lose from here? My opponent goes, Lesser Masticore, discarding Smiting Helix. And I was like, man, I feel bad all of a sudden. Look at the Lava Dart.
So, Dan, you did try a couple other sort of Bolas of Citadel shells again. Still trying to, you know, tweak the gauges a little bit, see if you can sneak some blood from a stone.
Yeah, I don't want to bore everyone with more of my Citadel ravings, but I was briefly off the deck until they spoiled that Scheming Symmetry card. And then I was like, well, if that's coming out next week, I should at least try to figure out, you know, where my best version sits right now. So I was tinkering around with the Lantern Control red-black version, and I did much better with it this time. I think partly because I just learned how to play the deck better.
It is a very complicated deck to play. It doesn't play like any other deck, so no lines are intuitive, to be fair.
Yeah, and, you know, I tweaked a few main deck cards, which just makes a big difference when you're kind of a prison lock strategy with tutors. And I guess the other main change was that, you know, A, the deck turns out to be very effective against Hogek. There's a lot of ways to lock them out, even in game 1, with an Ensnaring Bridge and then like a Pithing Needle on Altar of Dementia. In game 2, even something like a Blood Moon can lock them out. So that ended up being like a very positive matchup. There's also just less artifact hate than there was. Whatever panic we were feeling about Karin the Great Creator has temporarily been set aside while we worry about the graveyard menace. So I only faced 1 Stony Silence effect in 2 leagues with the deck this week. So there may be something there, and it may be time to revisit this list. Stay tuned for that.
Yeah, it's certainly true that if you just like despise Tron, which I know a number of people do, perhaps not unfairly, it's a pretty good time for Modern. There's not that much Tron these days.
To the point that I started building my decks with literally 0 cards for Tron, and of course in my last 2 leagues, I played Tron the 5th game. I was like, alright, you know, this is going to be a 4-1, easy, and then there's just like, no, natural Tron on 3, just like, there's just no game to be played here. Like, alright, tip the cap to that guy, you know, he's just, or gal, he's just...
Natural Trinity.
Never fails.
They came as 3. Yeah. Mind the power, plant the tower. Oh, wait, that's referring to Eldrazi.
So, just looking ahead, we've been sort of trying to get our heads around this Modern Horizons shakeup, but there's another set coming out, I want to say the pre-release is next weekend, which means it'll be, Core 2020 will be available online like a week from Thursday. So, we have the full spoiler. Any cards caught your eye? I know we talked about a few last week.
I want to talk about a card that I think people are going way too crazy about, or at least proposing shells that are crazy for, which is Brought Back. This card is a white instant. Choose up to 2 target permanent cards in your graveyard that were just put there from the battlefield this turn. Return them to the battlefield tapped. And I have seen, I don't know, like 30 different people be like, oh man, this is so crazy in blue white. You just play like 2 fetch lands. Then on turn 2, you know, you double ramp. And then turn 3, you play Teferi. You cannot do that. That is not a thing you can actually do in Modern, is just play fetch land, do nothing, play fetch land, do nothing. Then also have all these other targets for all your fetches. You know, there are uses for Brought Back. I think it's a really cool card. I don't think playing it fair like that to hopefully ramp is a way to do it. I think you have to use it as like another sort of weaker eggs piece, maybe play with bauble, some sort of sacrifice outlet. But the way that people are describing playing with it makes me think that like people don't actually play games of Modern. They just like imagine these scenarios.
So you make some good points, but I also strongly disagree. I strongly agree and strongly disagree. I feel strongly.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that the scenario you're talking about of like play fetch land, leave it uncracked. You know, this isn't Legacy. We can't do that, right? You have to use your mana every turn. But I mean, that could come up, and I think just like adding a single Mistress Bauble to the equation makes it very doable. I think the actual better core for that would be the Flagstones Ghost Quarter combo, I guess we'll call it, because there you actually can use your mana, and then whenever you're ready, you know, that will get two lands in the graveyard. You target your own Flagstones with the Ghost Quarter. It's a mana neutral play because the Ghost Quarter gives you an untapped basic and you can float a white from the Flagstones, and then you have two in the graveyard which you can get back with brought back. So I think like the possibility of ramping with this in that kind of mana base is actually quite intriguing to me.
I would, instead of saying ramp, I would say, what if I use that Flagstones to cast a turn one Steplinks, and then I did like a jillion damage to somebody?
Okay. Let me think about that.
Steplinks is a sweet card, even if it's not that good in Modern anymore.
So, I mean, there are a few cards that in Core 2020 that had me thinking about Flagstones, right? We talked about, we didn't talk about it yet, but Elvish Reclaimer. He's kind of like a Knight of the Reliquary, but hopefully this one doesn't suck. He is a 1/2 elf for a green that becomes a 3/4 if you have three or more land cards in your graveyard. He has an activated ability, pay two and tap him, sacrifice any land to fetch any land out of your deck. So that, I think you wouldn't want to build around that because it's just so slow. I think he's more like a Wild in the Kettle, but in theory he could sack a Flagstones to get a Flagstones, which Knight of the Reliquary can't do. There's also this new Lotus Field, which sacks two lands when it comes into play. So suddenly we're getting interested in sacrificing lands. I'm not sure if there's anything there, but Flagstones are cheap right now. They're reprinted in Ultimate Masters, so if you're interested in that, you know, it doesn't hurt to pick them up.
Also, just so we're clear, the line I outlined attacks for 14 on turn 2 earlier, so just keep that in mind. If you like doing that, I don't know, maybe you like doing 14 damage on turn 2.
And having five lands in play on turn 3.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, whatever you're into, just...
Wait, 14 damage? Are you sure about that?
Yeah.
Are you sure that you didn't account for the fact they come back tapped?
Oh, I did not. My apologies. 10 damage.
10 damage. All right.
Failed combos aside, I still think this card is one of the more exciting...
I think it's great. I just think you don't want to play it that fairly. I think you want to be doing something pseudo-combo-ish, at least, with it. You can't just use it as, like, a conditional double rampant growth.
I mean, there's no such card as a double rampant growth for two. Like, we've never seen a card at that rate.
I agree. This isn't that either, so...
Maybe it is, though. Maybe it's worth trying to make it into that. This reminds me of, like, the difference between Eldritch Evolution and Neoform. Like, 3 mana versus 2 mana, it's a universe of difference in Modern. So at 3 mana, sure, you can do a Renegade Rallyer. No one really tries that because it's not worth it. But at 2 mana, it's not only is it 1 mana cheaper, but you get twice the effect. Like, I don't know. I think it's worth trying to use it as a ramp card.
It's even instant speed ramp, right?
Yes.
You can hold mana up for their turn and then brought back your stuff.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be lands either. It's extremely versatile. So in any case, I'm sure we'll be revisiting this card. Other cards that have tickled your fancy at all?
Colossus's Hammer, I think, is a super sweet card. I think they kind of made this card as like a meme, as a joke, but I actually think it's really good. I'm going to be brewing a deck around it that I think is going to be like somewhat competitive, like surprisingly so. So this card, just to clarify, is a 1 mana equipment. Equipped creature gets +10/+10 and loses flying, and the equip cost is 8.
No problem.
Yeah.
I mean, if you just cast brought back a few times.
Yeah, you got so much mana.
Are you going to pay 8? I'm guessing you're not going to pay 8.
No, I'm going to play a certain paladin from the original, or the second Mirrodin block. Yeah, the second Mirrodin block, who will draw me a card when I play Colossus Hammer, and then if I have Metalcrafts, he will allow me to equip for free.
So my worry there is that once you start putting those cards in the deck, you just have the beginnings of a Cheerios deck that is equally crippled without the Pure Steel Paladin, but lacks the combo kill potential. Are you going to be playing redundant copies of the equip for free effect? Like Sigarda's Aid or
There's a 2-mana bear. It's a white-white for a 2/2 that when it comes into play, you can equip a creature. I'd have to look at the actual shell. I think the Cheerios, you can make this list with just like two Colossus Hammer, so you don't need the card to even function to do anything. You can play Trinket Mage, and you can play the Poison Artifact Land, so that Colossus Hammer is lethal.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not convinced that anybody in the history of competitive Magic has ever used Pure Steel Paladin just for value. Like, oh, my Batterskull can move around anywhere, anytime.
You guys will be seeing a fully fledged list at some point, so you might as well just prep all your derisive remarks. It's a lock. There's nothing that can stop it now.
There's only one way to be sure. That
a series of 1/4 performances where I blame bad draws, and then we just move on and never talk about it again.
All right. I've got one that people are excited about. It's Thunderkin Awakener. This is a 2-mana elemental. I think it's a 1/2 haste for 1 and a red. And when it attacks, you get to return an elemental from your graveyard to the battlefield that has a toughness less than or equal to... Sorry, less than. Just less than the toughness of this elemental. And that elemental comes back attacking. So, people are... They're excited about this card with Lightning Skelemental, the ball lightning, bulb lightning variant. Some people want to go deeper than that. They want to play 8-ball with actual ball lightning.
This sounds kind of meme-ish, but I actually think this deck is really good. And in this week's 5-0, there was someone who was already playing like Unearth, Old Pyromancer, Faithless Looting, and the Skelemental. So that's already a shell that can 5-0 at least, whatever that means. If you add this 1/2 to that, Unearth is very powerful. And with all these ways to like fill your graveyard with these things, and because it has haste, so the turn you play, you get to attack. I think that deck is going to be very good. Now, it uses the graveyard a lot, so it can be hated out quite easily, but I think it's very powerful.
Cast your Skelementals at their normal rate.
That list has, I think, put up a couple 5-0s already, actually. So, Skelemental, just a heads up if you're listening out there. If you follow MTG Finance right now, there's been like a weird quick price reversal on the Horizons cards that are actually proving themselves to be playable. Like Aria of Flame went up to like $7 from being below $1 a few days ago. Ren and Six has doubled in price. It's now like the Chase Mythic of the set. Skelemental, I believe, is going to be a 4 of in a modern deck. It's already, and this is even before the core 2020 spoilers with their elemental theme. So get yours now. They're still under $1. And yeah, this deck might be actually something good. The reanimation angle might just open up additional weaknesses that are unnecessary. But
good news is you don't have to go all in on the reanimation. I mean, first off, the elementals tend to die on their own. Like, that's the whole point of how Skelemental works. And secondly, like, yeah, if you play Faithless Looting, you know, they could have a ley line, but that's okay. That doesn't make Faithless Looting terrible.
And Unearth has cycling. I think it's the perfect mix of just enough graveyard that you get people to actually overboard against you, and they bring in all these rest in pieces, and you play a 3-mana 6/6 that causes them to discard too. And I mean, the game is over.
It certainly makes it at least approximately 1/3 of the way over.
Well, if they play a Rest in Peace that doesn't matter to you because you've sideboarded out your graveyard stuff and then you hit them for 6 and cause them to discard 2, you're up 4 cards functionally.
Yeah, I mean, Thunderkin Awakener is certainly not a very good card if there's no graveyard. So you have to side out all your Unearths and your Thunderkin Awakeners and maybe your Lootings. Like, yeah, it's a little tricky to do that big of a sideboard swap.
This is true.
So any other cards that we have our eye on? Early look at Core 2020?
I mean, there's some interesting cycle of color hosers. Some of them look pretty good, some of them don't. So, for example, Fry is 1 and a red for an instant, can't be countered, deals 5 damage to target creature or planeswalker that's white or blue. So it's like a bigger upgrade to Rending Volley. It hits planeswalkers and does 1 more damage. So it answers Baneslayer along with Teferi. Pretty big game, whereas Rending Volley is a cheaper answer to Thing in the Ice. And so it's not clear how that's going to shake out as to which one's better. But one of the nice things is that Rending Volley is a meta card. You only play it when conditions are right, if there's a lot of blue-white cards running around. And so same with Fry. The whole cycle, really.
I was very happy to see that they printed Fry. I sometimes get demoralized playing against these blue-white planeswalkers. I feel like very jealous and angry. I'm like, why did they get such generous rates? And then I saw that Force of Negation could protect them. Just protect your value engine. I was like, no. But at least now we have an uncounterable card that, even though it will suck to have to burn that on a Teferi 3 after they've bounced our creature and drawn a card for their troubles, we'll at least kill it dead.
Actually, Magmatic Sinkhole is seems like a pretty powerful card that's going to make some constructed waves, and is also a nice flexible red answer to Planeswalkers.
Yeah, I think that Sinkhole has already become like a staple of a lot of these blue-red decks.
Delve.
Just going straight into my Camlander deck. Somehow white got screwed with Devout Decree, which is just like a sorcery speed Celestial Purge that doesn't hit Blood Moon and Scry ones, which is like, I think that's overall, I mean, the instant speed alone is not, is more important than Scrying one, I would say.
I agree completely. The card is literally unplayable. Maybe in standard, but.
So I have my eye on Mystic Forge, which is yet another in the line of Future Sight style cards, which get progressively less special every time they print a new one. First there was Precognition Field, and then there was Experimental Frenzy, you know, Bolas of Citadel, and now Mystic Forge.
A Future Sight?
Yeah, this is the lineage of Future Sight. I skipped Omegas of the Future. Future Sight was sweet, and it's now Modern Legal, apparently. So this one, a little bit boring. It only casts artifacts and colorless cards. It does not let you play lands, but it comes with a built-in way to clear the top card of your deck. You just pay one life and tap it. So in a sense, like you, that's the equivalent of making your land drop. Like, if there's one land on top, you can clear it away. I think the most intriguing thing about this is that it is a 4-mana artifact. So you can War of Invention for it at a reasonable turn of the game. Obviously, my thinking has been heavily clouded by all these lantern pieces that I've been playing, but that is a efficient way to get a bunch of cards per turn off this. Unlike Bolas of Citadel, that doesn't provide mana, so you will eventually like run out of mana to cast the top card of your deck. But if you want to go off, you could. You could play an Aetherium Sculptor or something like that. I'm not saying you should, but I'm going to be tinkering with this card, and we'll see if I come up with anything that is worthy of presentation.
It seems like you're just not going to have enough artifacts in your deck. I mean, that can't be like more than... It's hard to build a deck that's like that many artifacts, like more than like 30 maybe.
True, but I mean, they don't need to all be artifacts. You just need to clear off the ones that are not. In any case, we'll see. That may prove to be too much of a challenge. Okay, well, that's an early look at cards that we may be having more to say about in the next coming weeks. So we're going to take a short break right now, and we'll be back with a flashback to report on our testing from last week's decks.
So last week, we kind of discussed a bunch of tempo builds, many of them involving Ice Fang Kotal, many of them involving Fairy Seer, the new 1-mana fairy, and several of them involving ninjas, depending on which build different ninjas were used. I think, Damon, you took the first run at with the Bug Ninja list through a league. What was your impression of that deck?
Yeah, the deck was pretty cool. I enjoyed it a lot. I went 3-2. But one of the losses was to Devoted Druid, where we really kind of handled all their creatures early on, but it flooded out a lot in the third game. And then one of the losses was to Hogak. The deck really just has no play against that deck game one. There's just not a chance. But games 2 and 3, we probably just need to add a couple of Ravenous Traps, and I managed to not mulligan into Leyline of the Void. So I should probably just get better at doing that.
Skill game.
But yeah, I thought that Fairy Seer was actually a lot better than I thought it would be. It provided a lot of value. I was always happy to have it on turn one. I liked Ingenious Infiltrator a lot. It actually provided a good amount of value at a cheap enough rate that you could manage to, you know, do it early or do it holding up Mana Leak or something. And then you can get a lot of value. They stack. If you have multiples, you just go insane. And then this flash package of Ice Fang Coatl, Snapcaster, Spellsutter Sprite, those felt pretty good. I would say Spellsutter Sprite was either amazing or terrible. That card is just a pretty swingy card. It feels pretty bad on the draw if you don't have a Fairy Seer to hit two drops on. You're just kind of always behind on the draw. You're frequently two turns behind on having enough fairies to matter. But when it's good, it's great. And you start amassing a fairy presence. I think Coatl was pretty good in the league. I played against Blue, White, and Green, Black, and I won both matches 2-0. It felt like having this card that is a flash threat to pressure Planeswalkers and then can get bounced with the ninjas to drive more value. It was really good. Those decks felt like they had a lot of trouble dealing with flash threats that have ETB value. There's nothing quite like discarding to hand size against a green-black opponent. It's just such a rare thing to happen. I'm still not quite sure about the counter spell package we ran, including 2 Cryptic Command, 2 Wizard's Retort, 1 Force of Negation, and 1 Mana Leak. Something felt a little bit off about that. Wizard's Retort was just frequently not what we needed. So honestly, maybe just more Mana Leaks or even Remand. Fallen Shinobi was interesting. The card is definitely hard to stop in the sense of removal, but it's actually quite easy to whiff in Modern. A lot of decks just play a lot of cards that you really don't really get value out of casting. Or if they do have cards of value, there's just like so few of them. Like if you're playing against a blue-white deck, there's just, you can hit it, you know, one of their planeswalkers and it's amazing, or you can hit some lands and a Cryptic Command and it's like, eh, I mean, I guess Cryptic's pretty good. But like, you'd also have like a Mana Leak and a Gate or like a Path on an empty board. And there's plenty of other decks in Modern that are kind of equally bad, like against like a Titan Shift deck. You either hit a Prime Time or you hit everything else you can hit is useless.
Yeah, you're not wrong, although I'll just mention I had a funny Fallen Shinobi game just today, actually, where I was dead to rights, but I managed to hit Runner, 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 Runner off the top of his deck to win the game and lock it out at the same time with his own Narset. This was against Phoenix. The swings. You gotta run with the swings.
I wonder if maybe Fallen Shinobi should be a sideboard card that you bring in against fair decks where they're, you know, you're got a much better chance to hit something like a Liliana or, yeah, a different Planeswalker or a Tarmogoyf or something. And so it's a card you can attack, but functionally it would almost have vigilance. It would very likely replace itself with some kind of other creature.
Yeah, my sense for the deck was that the deck already had a pretty good fair matchup.
That was my sense too as well.
Tune it more towards the unfair decks. And Fallen Shinobi feels like it's bad against the unfair decks. It's just not that likely that you're going to get something useful off of a Hogak deck or in game one survive to activate the Fallen Shinobi in the first place.
How many were you playing in your list?
Three.
So you had four Ingenious Infiltrator, three Fallen Shinobi.
Yeah. Infiltrator felt actually quite good. Getting to draw a card from your deck that you know has cards that you want to draw, that's why they're in there. And it's just a lot more nimble to get that guy up and running.
So I ran a very similar list with feedback from you, Damon. I cut the Wizard's Retorts, you know, on your suggestion. I didn't play Fallen Shinobi because you seemed a little meh on the card. I also went 3-2. I hate to say it because this is really Dan's feedback, but I thought Snapcaster Mage maybe wasn't worthy of a 4-of inclusion. I really dislike the card Opt, actually. I think the deck is so weak in its board presence. Like, the ability to Opt first turn, then eventually Snapcaster Opt is just way too slow for what we're trying to do. And I think it's not a surprise to see that the bigger ninjas list that have been 5-0-ing, and I think, Dan, you ran one through a league, they kind of abandon that like value plan, and they are trying to end the game a lot faster. They don't play any Snapcaster Mages at all, I don't believe, and they don't play that many instants or sorceries. So yeah, I think that the Bug Ninja shell can still be done in the way that Damon and I are describing with the four Ingenious Infiltrator. I'm really surprised the list, that other list isn't playing them at all, but I think you maybe need to rethink the other cards in the list. And I would, it seems weird, but I would maybe think about cutting three or maybe all of the Snapcaster Mages and all the Ops.
This is a big moment. I got to make sure we recorded this. I never thought I'd hear you say this.
It's on record. I do love a Snapcaster Mage, but I mean, you just get so much value with the ninjas. I don't think you need Snapcaster Mage, having played through a couple leagues with various ninja-ish builds.
Well, you've heard me rant about this, but yeah, they're sneakily expensive, and I think the ninjas are already quite expensive. I was wondering if, Damon or Dave, you felt like using ninjutsu on a card like the Ingenious Infiltrator was setting you too far behind.
Especially on turn two, it felt insane. And because you could oftentimes, like Damon is saying, it's so cheap, you could like on turn four play a Kotal end of turn and then attack, you know, ninja it in, and you still have two mana optics to cast, you know, whatever, Spellslayer Sprite or Mana Leak or whatever.
Yeah, Fallen Shinobi felt a little on the clunky side just because frequently you have to tap out, which means you can't protect it against a path ever, basically, unless you have like a lot of mana available. And once you do it, you're really at the mercy of the cards you hit and whatever boards that you have going on to stop your opponent for an entire turn cycle. And in a deck that, you know, features a bunch of pretty solid instants that can help you survive a turn cycle, that felt not that great. Infiltrator was the opposite. It made sure you always had access to the cards you needed and would have the mana up to do it if you needed to. You could just, you know, you don't have to run it out on turn two if they're holding up a bolt type effect. You can wait till you have a counterspell ready. The ninjutsu tempo was fine. I mean, this deck doesn't have a super fast clock. It wins by getting a lot of card advantage and then using that to really seal the deal. Even if you don't have the cleanest answers to their cards, having a couple cryptics that you'll draw into will just give you inevitability as long as you're up enough cards. And bouncing a Nice Fang Coattle or Fairy Seer is just not a big tempo negative play. Usually it's the value you get from recasting them is more than outweighs having to spend the mana to cast them.
Well, I'm a little surprised to hear that, but I guess then again, I was just saying that there's been a lack of aggro in the league, or I don't know about in the leagues, but in the tier one meta right now. So maybe it's just the case that, like, yeah, you can afford to sort of juke and weave around opposing removal and not have to worry about blocking or something like that. Dave, I watched a couple of your matches, and it seemed like, you know, against the humans player, like, it was kind of tricky. Like, once they got on the board, if they went creature, 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 you were hard pressed to come back from that. Just the cards in your deck could not actually assemble defense in time.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I think Icefang Kotal is a really, really well-designed card. It's not Baleful Strix all the time, and it is a real cost to have to get three basics in play on turn two, especially when you want to play it in a three-color deck, which we're trying to do. So, yeah, there's a bunch of, like, you know, turn one and two, like, what lands do I fetch? What cards do I want to have access to? Do I want to make sure that I have Death Touch on my Kotal to trade for, you know, all the humans that are growing? Or do I need to make sure I'm, you know, not taking too much damage when I'm fetching? So those are all really interesting questions. And yeah, I think it's the other thing that happened a couple times is I ninja'd Icefang Kotal, and then they flashed in with another vial a Meddling Mage that said Kotal, because they obviously knew that I had one in my hand. So that was really cool. A cool play by the humans player. I did think that humans was like the one fair matchup where I didn't feel great about it, because you do need to actually have a lot of removal, and the ninja deck does not, and your creatures stop being able to get through pretty quickly.
But a 1 week matchup in a wide field is actually not a big deal, so yeah, maybe there's something there.
Well, you have weak matchups against the unfair decks as well, though, which is what Damon was saying. I think I lost to a Hogak deck myself. But yeah, it's if you like beating the shit out of blue-white, it just feels amazing. Like, what are they even doing there?
Occasionally they can, you know, if they get a good sweeper and they actually can set you back a fair amount. But yeah.
I was playing two V-clicks in my list, so that wasn't really happening for them either.
So after hearing from you guys about your experience with the little ninjas with Ingenious Infiltrator, I want to at least try one league with the big ninjas. And this is the list that you can find. A couple people have made 5-0 with this already, where the ninjas they're playing are four each of the Mist Syndicate Naga and the Fallen Shinobi. And then supporting creatures are Fairy Seer, Icefang Kotal, and then Tarmogoyf, actually, instead of Snapcaster Mage or some other flying creature like Spellstutter. Just like a big, beefy guy to hold the ground. So like those, like a 20-creature package, and then the usual suspect of spells, but actually the one spell that was missing was a cantrip. So there's no Serum Visions, there's no Opts, right? It's just removal spells and a few counter spells, so Fatal Push, Assassin's Trophy, and actually there was a Dead of Winter in the main deck of the list that I was using that actually I really liked that. I think partly because I was reacting to having seen how hard it was to come back from an aggressive board, like sweepers helped a lot. And this list was pretty good. I went 4-1 in my league. I played a couple Infect decks, Hogak deck. The other two matchups escape me right now, but oh yeah, is it Phoenix?
Who did you lose to, Dan?
I lost to Hogak only because I made the classic mistake of, you know, you look at your hand game three, it has a Nihil Spellbomb and is otherwise like an okay hand. And you're like, oh, this might get there, but it won't. I had four Ley Lines in the deck for a reason, and I should have just mulliganed for them. So that was on me. Like a single Nihil Spellbomb on the draw in game three is not going to get there. But the Phoenix match was the one I referred to where that was actually the first match where I was able to cast a Fallen Shinobi. And at two life, I managed to hit a Lightning Bolt and a Sleight of Hand, which gave me a removal spell off my deck to kill two Phoenixes and then a Narset and something else. And it was amazing. But apart from that one game, the Shinobi was not amazing. That one was very hard to cast. I think one thing that shocked me about these lists was that the first one only had 20 lands. And I think I went up to 22 lands because I thought 20 lands was insanely greedy.
Yeah, with no cantrips.
Yeah, no cantrips and like four Fallen Shinobis. That's crazy. Like, that's actually crazy.
Fairy Seer and Icefang Kotal are kind of cantrips.
That is insanely greedy.
I lost a lot of games. Dan saw me that it's hard to say I would have won or lost, but I was stuck on like two lands for huge stretches of time. And that's, I think I played 20 lands with four Opt. I think what I would consider doing if you had to play a small fairies list is replace the Opts with birds, but still play 20 lands. Then your like turn two ninja is a little more frequent because you have the Bird of Paradise. It also helps your mana. I think Bird of Paradise is just really good. I would consider some amount of them in any small ninja list. In this list where you're actually trying to just play sort of like a Sultai Jund-like build, but that has ninjas, I don't think you want the bird.
Yeah, not for this list. I think Sultai Jund is a nice way of putting it. It's like Ninja Jund, where these cards are so big, and each one is like a standalone threat that can just clean up on its own. The Mist Syndicate Naga was actually really good. Like, what I liked about it was that it let you tap out to, like, get this threat in play, and then it left you with an untapped 3-1 that could still defend and trade. So I think that, like, that card is actually... If we think the Ingenious Infiltrator is a good ninja, Miss Syndicate might be the second best ninja, I think.
My concern with that card is, like a lot of ninjas, it is soft to lots of removal, but it's soft to a really specific removal card that I've had played against me a lot, which is Lava Dart. That card already is amazing against these types of decks because it kills Kotal and Fairy Seer. But if it kills your 3-mana play that also put a card back in your hand, I mean, that's tough.
Yeah, but I wouldn't expect to face that very often. So, I mean, that would be a case where the Naga is not going to work in that matchup. But, like, that's one matchup out of however many.
Naga going to work in that matchup.
Naga not going to work here anymore. The Office Space fans out there. But what was interesting about this deck to me was, like, how these ninjas, they just sort of hung out in your hand and contributed nothing to the crucial turns. Like, the game was decided by the other card, you know, the Ice Fangs, the Tarmogoyfs, the removal spells, the discard spells. They're out here hustling, like, trying to stabilize the board. And, like, meanwhile, the ninjas are just chilling in your hand. They're waiting. They're waiting for, like, a window.
Lurking. Yeah, that's the term they prefer, Dan.
8 ninjas is a lot of ninjas. I mean,
it was far too many ninjas.
Shout out to these people who are 5-0-ing with the list. But, I mean, I feel like the optimal build is still out there, and maybe we're iterating towards it.
Yeah, there's a lot of 4-drops that require setup in the Fallen Shinobi.
Yeah.
So I'm coming around to your suggestion of, like, sideboarding those in the matchups where they're good. You don't need 8 of these big ninjas, for sure. And they exist in that weird space where it's like, they play them when you haven't quite won the game yet. They can kind of they can nudge you toward being ahead, but they don't win outright. And they certainly don't defend you. So they're just weird cards. But they're very cool. So, interesting deck. I think I would maybe iterate on this with fewer of the big ninjas.
Would you bring in little ninjas?
I could see a list that was featuring the Miss Syndicate Naga and the Ingenious Infiltrator as the primary ninjas. And then maybe you can bring in Fallen Shinobis when appropriate.
Like, would you even run Fairy Seer if you're not running a lot of ninjas? Like, that card seems only good because of the ninjas too.
Well, it was necessary. I mean, it had so many hands that were like one land Fairy Seer.
It's the working man's Serum Visions.
Yeah, I mean, those hands tended to work out okay, I guess. I mean, I was happy I was up to 22 lands. I played a Colony Garden as a 22nd land at your suggestion, Damon. I don't know if you were serious about that, but I got 2 ninjas off of it the 2 times that I played it. So.
Yeah, it was just, I wasn't like, this card is seriously good, but it was like, this card is interesting. The comparison I was making was Colony Garden to Fairy Seer is Fairy Seer is a good ninjutsu trigger that it comes down on 1 and lets you play an infiltrator on 2. And along the way, if you get to do that twice, you've spent a card and you've gone to scry 2 twice and you get a 1/1 flyer out of it. Whereas Colony Garden basically is like a free ninjutsu creature. All you've spent is a slightly inefficient land drop. And so it actually compares kind of favorably for that specific setup.
Although you can never turn 2 infiltrator off it, right? I mean, because it's a green land.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't really thought too hard about it.
Another shell I'm interested in pursuing is just a straight blue-black list that plays 4 Fairy Seer, 4 Changeling Outcast. So those are... Changeling Outcast is interesting because it is a ninja, so if it hits and you have a infiltrator in play, it triggers as a ninja, but it also is a fairy for Spellstutter Sprite.
Are you describing a modern deck or a sweet Modern Horizons F deck?
I'm describing first one and then the other. You'll get a lot more wins in one of the formats.
Many players ask if there's like an entry-level deck that they can upgrade to a modern deck. Well, you can enroll in a Modern Horizons draft at your local store. Draft a blue-black ninja deck and slowly
and then
upgrade
bring
it.
The exact 75 that I'll be playing in GP Minneapolis. So a list that had 0 promise that I played was the blue-green Curious Obsession with Ice Fang Kotal. I will say the games against the fair decks were, like, super interesting. It's, like, it was a big brain puzzle to try to, like, eke out enough damage. But, man, like, all your cards are underpowered. I got the sweet, like, opening play of turn 1 Fairy Seer, turn 2 equip it with a protection spell, and it died immediately both times. Like, there's just so much cheap removal in Modern. This isn't Standard. They actually let you play with, like, good cards. So, you know, Jund cast Lightning Bolt, use spell, whatever, you counter it, and then they, you know, fatal push your guy. And, you know, some cards are good against one, like Spell Pierce is good against Liliana, but if you have the Hexproof card and they play Liliana, it doesn't stop that. On and on. So, yeah, it was a bloodbath in certain matchups. And then the ones where it was close, it was like I had to sit there and puzzle over each turn just to eke out enough damage to win. So I think there's nothing there. I don't think there's anything worth exploring.
So remind us, this is a list that was kind of modeled off the standard mono blue deck. Is that
yeah, right? So I took a similar ratio of like creatures, counterspells, and lands to, they don't call them Pro Tours anymore, but Pro Tour Champion. And they had played a mono blue list that kind of, their goal was to sort of play turn one, flying creature, turn two, equip it with Curious Obsession and protect it. And then, you know, the rest of the deck had some kind of like tricky little cards and then basically like some tempo plays. But the goal was to try to like, you know, hit for two, draw a card each turn and kind of play all these cheap interactive spells that traded for your opponent's things until they kind of ran out of time to stop your beatdown. But in modern, that is much harder to accomplish because of how cheap all the interaction spells they play are.
Yeah, I can see that. In standard, you usually trade up on mana when you're, you know, using a dive down to counter their
right
cast down or whatever. But in modern, that's not the case.
And, you know, they turn two, they Inquisition you. Like, do they have removal or not? You don't know. So you've got one Spell Pierce. They're going to take it if they need to and cast their removal spell. Yeah, you're behind a rock in a hard place. Now, there's a new flash blue 1/1 flyer that also has three blue colon draw card. If you want to incinerate some tickets after M20 comes out, you could try a new build with that.
Well, not just that card, but there's the Flash Tarmogoyf.
Yeah, there you go. So I will be incinerating a lot more tickets, failing to interact with anyone else.
Tickets aren't real anyway.
I agree. Anyway, it was a worthy experiment. There's nothing there. But I did like the idea of like a bigger Fan Flash deck. So one that uses Restoration Angel, Iceman Kotal, and then even Noble Hierarch. So sort of like the blue-white kind of mid-range Flash deck sees play from time to time. This is basically like Splash and Green for Kotal and Hierarch. And then you get to play Snapcaster Mage, and which is a little bit better in this deck because it's a little bit more bigger mana. I think I played 24 lands, and that felt really good. The deck has a lot of game to it. It's very fun to play, and you can really kind of tweak it out to beat whatever decks you want. Dan, you played kind of a different list, but with a similar concept. You were playing Spellcaller instead of the Snapcaster Mage package, basically.
Yeah, just sort of keeping with my disdain for Snapcaster Mage. I had two Snapcasters, but I wanted to play one of my favorite Flash creatures, a Spellqueller, in conjunction with Teferi Time Reveler, because those are like a nice little 1-2 punch. The Teferi static ability, in addition to just messing them up, like means that the Spellqueller is a permanent removal, and you can even bounce the Spellqueller to get it back and just do it again. They won't get their spell back. It will remain quelled. So yeah, that deck was essentially the same core as what you're describing, but just with that different package. It was fun. I just played one league with it and just got mired in a bunch of mid-range slugfests. I had one match against Burn that I lost very quickly, and that was a breath of fresh air because the other four rounds were just so exhausting against other creature mid-range decks and one control deck. I think
Isn't this supposed to be a fun Magic, Dan?
It was fun, but it's so hard.
Yeah, that's what people keep saying they want. I don't want to be these two linear decks just racing each other without even glass cannons. You play these 2, 3, and 4 spells and interacting, and you're just like, oh, god damn it, I've had enough of this Magic.
It was exactly like you're describing, Dave. It was, yeah, mentally taxing. I even played against Eldrazi Taxes in one of them. So it was like literally and figuratively taxing, and those were some insane games. The Spellqueller package was okay. I think it had some weaknesses that I wasn't quite expecting when I was drawing up in my mind. One being that like I wasn't winning combat as readily as I thought I would. Like once the opponent's deck was putting creatures in play, I actually had to use Path to Exiles to actually not die. And my paths were just pretty taxed. Then like once, you know, if they had a lot of removal, the Spellquellers were not keeping the spells quelled. So I still felt like even though I had the Ice Fang to like sort of hopefully shore up the two slot, I ran into that problem you were talking about, Dave, where, you know, I didn't always have snow as my first three lands. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't quite defend with it on turn two. So like a couple of games I was like, oh, I'm really on the back foot here. I have two Ice Fangs, but they don't have Death Touch yet. And it's like, this is going to cost me the game potentially. So that was interesting to learn because I had I had trimmed a couple of snow basics, so I thought, you know, I want some more dual lands, some fast lands, some horizon lands, which were good, but there was a trade-off. The second thing that really stood out to me from that league was the card Winds of Abandon, which Damon has experienced the draft side of that. That card is actually really good and constructed, at least in these matchups that I was playing. I had them in the sideboard. I had just one, but I think I would go up to three if I were playing the deck again and possibly move one to the main deck. That card is quite good. And it actually showed up quite a lot in the 5-0 deck dump today in a few different lists. So I think people should give this card a second look as just like a great removal option. You know, it's not that much worse than a Path to Exile, and sometimes you want more than four paths. And sometimes it's just like a massive one-sided blowout.
There's a screenshot that Dan will post to the Twitter feed from my league that is so, so sweet. Oh, God. It just makes it all worthwhile. Now, the one thing I would say about if you're going to play Winds of Abandon and Path to Exile, I would really consider not using mana leak or very few mana leaks, because you are giving your opponents a ton of mana.
True.
Especially with Snapcaster Mage. It happened multiple times that I'd ramp my opponent to like 5 or 6 mana, and then I could not like mana leak Tarmogoyf on turn 3 or 4.
Yeah, the card Winds of Abandon does seem quite good. At first, I dismiss it as being just like too much worse than Path to make sense in Modern, but the overload ability is just like insane.
I don't necessarily like it as a main deck card, but I certainly think at least one should be in a sideboard for like any matchup you think is going to go long, because just getting like even a 2-for-1 with it is awesome. And if you get a 6-for-1 as the screenshot, or 7-for-1, which the screenshot will show, that feels pretty good. I won that game.
It's interesting in the sense that you say it's more of a sideboard card, but it's basically a split card. It says either Point Removal or Wrath or Plague Wind, really. And frequently that makes it more flexible, and that makes it more main deckable.
Yeah, I like it as a main deck card even as well. And I think I saw one list in today's dump that had 3 of them main deck on top of 4 paths. So, yeah, so that was our experience with sort of just Ice Fang as a card in these Flash strategies that kind of maybe make Flash more of a thing. Yeah, I was satisfied with the card. I still think, you know, it's probably the best 2-drop right now for that kind of deck. And the 2-drop in any kind of green-white or banned creature deck is always kind of like disappointing. If it's not Thalia, Garden of Thraben, it's kind of disappointing against the field. So Ice Fang is good. The strategy itself still has its usual weaknesses. That was my takeaway, at least.
Yeah, my takeaway is the card is really, really well designed. It's not overpowered. It's not as miserable to play with or against as Baleful Strix, where it kind of just leads to these stalls. You have to work to turn on the Death Touch ability, so be very conscious of how you build your mana base. If you could just play blue-green straight, it would be amazing, but I don't think you can because you don't have enough removal in those two colors. So even that's kind of cool. So yeah, just a cool card. The deck plays, it really suits my preferred style of play. And of course, it's amazing with Restoration Angel.
Truth. That'll do it for our flashback on the Ninja Snake Fairy tempo strategies from last week. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with some fresh brews for next week.
All right, welcome back. We are here to talk about our brew target card of the week. This one is going to be Force of Virtue. I had this card in a draft once for Modern Horizons. It was great, but we think it might be good enough to make Constructed Waves. Dan, what's the first thing you want to discuss with it?
First, tell us what the card does, because this is one of the bad forces, so I think it might not be on everyone's radar.
Oh, that's fair. That's fair. It's still cheap also. First off, it has some sweet art. Check it out.
Worth noting.
Listing the pros first, all the positives first.
But yeah, it's 2 white-white for an enchantment, and it has the Force Clause. If it's not your turn, you may exile a white card from your hand instead of paying for it. It has Flash, and it gives your creatures +1/+1. So stepping from a long tradition back from Crusade through Glorious Anthem through Honor of the Pure and other such effects, this continues their lineage, but with the ability to be played for free at Flash speed.
Weird timing on that. Like, why would you want a Flash Speed Crusade on their turn? But that's what it is.
I did it once in a draft game where I think it actually led me astray. I was like, I could do it now. That's awesome. I should. And I was like, actually, maybe I shouldn't have. But yeah, I agree. It is a little bit strange.
So, Dave, I would like to hear from you on this card, because I think you pointed this card out to me and I got the wheels turning. But tell me what you have in mind for this one.
So when this card was spoiled, I kind of had the same reaction you guys did, which is, man, blue has this sweet force that, you know, is going to see a lot of play, at least as a sideboard card. we proposed a bunch of lists with it already. And white kind of got screwed again. And I think Saffron Olive even made the joke on Twitter, like, oh, this is kind of like a meta commentary on the original, you know, ancestral versus healing salve. Like, the cycles, this is the ultimate callback where the cycles are really unbalanced. And, you know, one is very powerful and the others are weak. But Gabriel Nassif, the Hall of Fame French player who streams quite regularly, and it's a great stream. I think people should check it out. He sort of mentioned in passing, as people were asking what cards he's interested in, that he was interested in this card. And I thought it was like a joke. You know, he kind of likes to troll his chat and stuff like that. But he pointed out that it's actually really kind of an interesting card with Squadron Hawk. And as soon as he said that, it just like a chord struck in my head. Like, Squadron Hawk is a very interesting card. It's very unique. You can spend 2 mana, you get a 1/1, and you draw 3 cards. But the problem is that the 3 cards you draw are very weak, right? They're 2 mana 1/1.
You gotta draw 3 cards, but they're all Squadron Hawks.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, it's like a Greek tragedy.
But this card does multiple things. One, it turns one of those cards into an immediate impact on the board. And 2, it makes the rest of the Squadron Hawks it doubles their power. And going from 1 to 2 is historically like a very big switch. So most token generators or cards like Squadron Hawk all have 1 power, and typically the cards that you use to buff them add an additional power, and those cards are the crucial key. So being able to play it for free is a way to sort of turn all this card advantage that's very inefficient and slow into, like, now you're efficiently affecting the board. And I think there's just a bunch of different shells you can build around that kind of interaction that try to take advantage of the Squadron Hawk thing. So the 2 lists that I think are most interesting are, you've named this one Goat Devotion, Dan. It basically takes like the white devotion shell, and in addition to buffing your creature, Force of Virtue also has 2 white pips. So it buffs your Squadron Hawk, and then if you have a Nykthos, Shrine to Nyx, it adds a bunch of mana to your mana pool and lets you play a bunch more creatures, which all get buffed by Force of Virtue, etc.
Let me stop you for a second. You said you take the white devotion shell, but there is no such thing as a white devotion deck, right? I mean,
Craig Wesco was on camera once at a Modern GP featuring a mono white devotion deck.
There it is.
I guess really? It never became popular, but yeah, if you just Google Craig Wesco mono white devotion, it'll show up.
So yeah, I did Google this and I watched it, and the game in question, he gets hosed and doesn't do anything, but he had a deck tech on his deck where he described it. And I thought it was kind of interesting. You know, Craig Wesco plays a lot of decks that aren't really my style of play, but he is very successful with them. And it was interesting to hear him explain why he brought a white devotion deck instead of his normal sort of Death and Taxes. I think he was like, you know, kind of one of the innovators of the green-white Death and Taxes shell. Yeah, so this uses some cards that he was recommending, some cards that he doesn't recommend. But basically, you have Squadron Hawk, and the one card that Dan recommended that I thought was great is Springjack Shepherd. So Springjack Shepherd really pays you off for having all these white pips. It gives you a bunch of creatures for the white pips, and then Force of Virtue makes these creatures actually be able to attack. And unlike, it has a very similar effect to the blue merfolk, whose name is escaping me, except the goats don't die when Springjack Shepherd
does. Master of Waves.
Master of Waves, exactly.
And that's a huge difference. It's a huge difference.
Yes. Yeah. And it has an ability called Chroma instead of Devotion.
You know, these things are hard.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I thought at first that you were talking about greatest of all time devotion, but no, it's Goat Devotion.
Yes, exactly.
And yeah, no, so you pair a Springjack Shepherd with a Springjack Pasture. Yeah, I guess your goats won't get lava darted with a Force of Virtue in play.
The other thing that I liked about this is Rest in Peace is a card that you may want to main deck with the way that the metagame is shaping up. And Rest in Peace has some tiny amount of value to this deck because it is a white pip for Nykthos, Shrine to Nyx, and it doesn't interfere with our plan at all.
It also is a card you can just pitch to the Force of Virtue if it's not relevant.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Yeah, the good old pitches to force argument.
Wow.
This deck plays, you know, multiple border posts, and then it has cards that combo sort of with that even. So you play the border post to get your extra white pips. Then you have Weathered Wayfarer and Knight of White Orchid, which sort of like help catch you up again. And Weathered Wayfarer can find your Nykthos. You don't have to play that many of them. And your Springjack Pasture. That's kind of included as a joke, but maybe it's worthwhile. Yeah, and then the rest of your cards are just sort of, you know, generic value cards. History of Benalia, again, it creates a bunch of creatures. While it's in play, it has 2 white pips. And then your kind of like mana sink cards are the Springjack Pasture, Quarantine Field, there's a one of Elish Norn, which buffs all your creatures and, you know, is just generally very sweet if you ever get to cast her. Or it. I guess I don't know that praetors have a gender as we understand it.
Can we talk about History of Benalia for a second? So this is a standard powerhouse, but I never really considered it for Modern. So are you saying, are you positing that this card is actually fine in terms of power level? Produces two knights and then it gives you a temporary buff?
Yeah, and you do have other knights in the list. So Knight of the White Orchid is obviously a knight, and so is Benalish Marshall. I think the original list I was thinking, I was going to try to like go all in on the Springjack Shepherd, History of Benalia, and also play Flicker Wisp, which has two white pips and is... But I don't know, that felt a little excessive. I don't know if History of Benalia is like Modern level power level. I know people tried it out kind of when it first came out. With how fast Modern is now, maybe it isn't good enough, but...
It's certainly a powerful Magic card.
Yes.
Craig Wesko had it in his list.
There you go. Who am I to question?
I can't believe I missed that deck, because I was thinking when we were talking about Force of Virtue, the first deck that came to mind was, of course, my Kitchen Table Goat deck, which uses the Border Posts and the Knight of the White Orchid, but I would have never brought that to a Modern tournament with a straight face. But here I'm looking at it right now. Craig Wesko, I mean, he's got Leyline of Sanctity 4 of in the main deck, which I think is not a good choice in today's meta, but Force of Virtue has the same number of Devotion pips and is like on plan, so I think potentially a massive upgrade there. You can still play Leyline on the board if you want to. He has Nevermore in his deck, which actually is a card that I was going to bring up myself, as I was thinking like this strategy sounds very cool and like what it can assemble, but it doesn't really disrupt the opponent in any way whatsoever. And I'm wondering if that's a problem, and should we be adding more prickly cards, or are there any cards like that?
Craig Wesko's original list featured a few more big mana payoffs off your Nykthos. First one being he had a 3 of Elish Norn, and I would say that card is a pretty prickly card. That card will single-handedly just completely crush a wide swath of decks in Modern. And then it featured 2 Quarantine Field, which seems like a cube all-star, but maybe if you actually have, you know, like 8 mana, that is pretty strong. That is a lot of prickles.
So he's really playing up the Nykthos element with 4 copies of a legendary land in a 17-land deck.
And 4 Weather Wayfarer, yeah. But it's more of a 25-land deck with the Border Posts.
I do get a little concerned, though. Like, I don't want to be all in on Nykthos. I want the deck to function fine without it, and just a couple of, like, sledgehammers at the top. I think you can get stuck very easily with a bunch of 5 and 6 mana cards in hand if they're playing, like, 2 Field of Ruins or something.
Yeah, I mean, you can even play that new, what is he called? That makes your lands not targetable. You are going to hit white-white on curve, I'm sure.
Tomic the Distinguished Advisor. Advocist?
Advocist, oh, yes. Jeez.
Tomic,
I didn't get a single word out of his name right.
He's your friendly neighborhood advocist.
Yeah, I mean, my concern is that if you don't go the big mana route with the payoffs, you're just playing like a bunch of creatures that are maybe not together, still not Modern power, in a format featuring, you know, strong control decks that are better than they've ever been, and they feature plenty of Wraths and decks that can try to kill you on turn 2 or so, Thing in the Ice, etc.
Do you see any way to address that weakness?
Yeah, I mean, I think that maybe the way I would see it is just, I'm not sure I trust the goat plan. Like, maybe you could just cut a few Springjack Shepherds for maybe like a few more of the big mana payoffs. You don't need like a ton of them.
You want to cut the goats?
Just a few. We can keep some. I'm also not sure we need 4 Benalish Marshall. That seems maybe like overkill. We already have 4 Force of Virtue. The effects kind of, they don't really get better in multiples. They get slightly worse because as a percentage change to your creature stats, it diminishes.
That slot might be better served with a go wide card that actually produces creatures like tokens or something.
We already have 3 history. I mean, that's kind of what that card is meant to be doing.
I was thinking Ranger Captain of Eos, who we've squandered some time on before. Like here, you know, I do want a 3 drop with 2 white pips in it. I do want extra cards in hand, because I might not draw Squadron Hawk, or I might draw extra Force of Virtues and want to have pitchable cards.
They're all pitchable. Like,
yeah, they're all pitchable.
I mean, they are, but like some of them are... Each card in the deck has like a different weight on its shoulders. Like, I don't want to pitch one of my real cards to it. I needed that card to actually do something else.
Yeah. I have pitched each and every single card in my Legacy deck to Force of Will. As long as it's blue, it will get pitched at some point. That's why you play more than one copy of the key cards.
And that's another nice thing about getting to play 8 Border Posts, is that's a cheap card to pitch to Force, or an easy card to pitch.
Well, it's not colored, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, well, they're colored. Yeah, you can hit them with Niv-Mizzet Reborn if you want to.
Huh, all right. Never mind.
So, yeah, I think there's a lot of different ways you could tweak this out. So, I mean, the cards that kind of are at the core of this build are the Force of Virtue Squadron Hawk tag team, and then to support that, you know, having these border posts, which in turn incentivize you to play Knight of the White Orchid. That's the core of the deck, and you just kind of fill in the curve around that. But the one slot, the three slot, and then the question of, like, are you trying to go higher on the curve with Nykthos, or are you just trying to play lower on the curve? Does that sound about right, Dave?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Like, I think the original list I proposed to you didn't even have Springjack Shepherd. And you're like, oh, you should, if you're playing White Devotion, why don't you just play this guy? And I was like, yeah, that's pretty sweet. And then you're like, oh, you should play Benelish Marshall, because that's three pips. I think I was proposing playing Brimoz.
Is there room in this deck for Winds of Abandon? It seems like if any deck is going to play that card, this deck could really use it.
Oh, yeah, that's a sweet call. There you go. You could put one or two of those guys in here. Maybe over Quarantine Field, or over the O-Ring, maybe.
No, I think this deck is not going to be fast enough to really want to have as many creatures as we have. I think that this is not going to be the zoo deck of the format. I think you need a little bit more of the kind of controlling cards as you do your thing. Like, even Squadron Hawk into Force of Virtue is still just like, you know, turn one Weather Wayfarer, turn two Squadron Hawk, EOT Force of Virtue. This still just isn't killing them anytime soon.
No, certainly not.
Especially because I'm going to be tapping my Weather Wayfarer for a land each turn.
Yes, Weather Wayfarer can never attack. It just is not possible.
There's no reason to. He can draw a card. That doesn't seem fair.
Yeah, so I honestly think there's more room to play fewer creatures and more of the kind of white catch-all answer cards.
Yeah, I think that Winds of Abandon is an awesome call. Yeah, I was told again to play Benelish Marshall, and then I was criticized for putting in the deck. So
that's how we do it here.
That's par for the course.
That's what this show was all about. Like, come on, Dave, Benelish Marshall.
Anyway, so that's one shell. And like Dan says, one of the fundamental problems with the shell is that it's not really a shell per se, because no one's playing White Devotion. You're not just adding it to some deck that's already having success. So another shell you could put it in is what I'm calling like a Mardu Tokens shell. So it's similar to the sort of Mardu list that Jerry Thompson top aided a Pro Tour with and has seen some success online in various contexts. And again, it tries to make use of the Squadron Hawk, drawing you a bunch of cards. And to do that, it has two Force of Virtue, so that's a card that works good with that. And then it has Seasoned Pyromancer. So one of the things you can do is like cast turn two Squadron Hawk, three Squadron Hawks. On their turn, cast Force of Virtue, pitch your Squadron Hawk. Then on your turn, you can cast Seasoned Pyromancer, discard your two Squadron Hawks, get two tokens, and then draw two new cards. But you still have like six cards in your hand, because Seasoned Pyromancer turns really quickly the card advantage you got from Squadron Hawk into actual like board presence, and then replaces them. That interaction is really interesting to me. Plus, Faithless Looting turning Squadron Hawk in matches where it's not useful into other things, that also is interesting. Collective Brutality, another card that like cheaply turns extra cards you have in your hand into actual real effects if that's what you need. And then I have a Judith of Scourge Diva as just sort of like a value card. We have a lot of token sort of generators in play, and she does a good job of turning those into the end of the game quite quickly.
So I initially thought that you had just lost it with this list. I thought this was crazy. I was like, what is he thinking? Like, he took Mardu Pyromancer and added Squadron Hawks to it and Force of Virtues. You don't even have any white cards to pitch. But then I'm like, actually, you know, maybe there's something to this, right? You're not playing the full set of force, but you're playing two, so a modest number of force. And then as the gears were turning, I was starting to like stumble upon the beauty, the genius of these Squadron Hawk interactions that you built into the shell. Where, yeah, I guess Squadron Hawk into Faithless Looting was always a thing you could do, but there was never any serious reason to do that. But Seasoned Pyromancer produces creatures, which like Squadron Hawk also produces a squad of creatures, so like you could build a deck envisioning that you're going to make a bunch of creatures like this. It's quite elegant, actually. I don't know if it's going to work, but it's a very cool concept.
Yeah, discarding a Squadron Hawk to get a 1/1 is almost like casting a Squadron Hawk. So the Seasoned Pyromancer interaction is pretty good here. A Mardu Pyromancer list featuring Seasoned Pyromancer actually made sixth place on the, I forget which of the two modern events it was.
Yeah, I think it's becoming a somewhere between a 2 and a 4 of in different decks as just like a fine card on its own.
I think a Junless also like won MCQ with two Season Pyromancer.
It did, yeah. Unlike the Goat Devotion list, we're looking at a list here that is mostly just good cards. It's even got a Smiting Helix, so it can't be bad. It has four Lingering Souls in the deck, which, you know, is a card that had fallen on tough times for a while, like during the pre-War of the Spark, you know, the reign of Thing of the Ice. Like, you were kind of old man behind the times if you were trying to cast Lingering Souls in any kind of deck. But, you know, maybe... And here we have extra incentive to be discarding cards because of the Seasoned Pyromancer together with Faithless Looting. And now we're really trying to like make something out of this go-wide token angle where it's not just like miserable 1-1s trying to chip away until they're out of resources. But with Force of Virtue, you know, every once in a while you will draw this card and suddenly, you know, the clock is real, hopefully.
I mean, do we even need Force of Virtue? Should we have introed this as a, hey, welcome to our card of the week, Squadron Hawk? Which is actually interesting here because of the looting and the Seasoned Pyromancer.
Well, I think that Dave has correctly identified that the Hawk and the Force go hand in hand. I think what I actually like is that you showed restraint with the Force of Virtue and only are proposing two copies. It reminded me of something that Canister, Pyotr Glogowski, was saying about this Grixis, Urza, War of Invention, Goblin Engineer deck that... is actually quietly doing very well. It appears to be one of like the new, still under the radar, but like breakout new deck archetypes from Modern Horizons. And he was saying that like the key to improving that deck was just like trimming down to three and two copies of cards that like looked like core cards, but you just didn't want to draw two. Even though it's like a great deck for Psy, Master Thalterist, a great deck for Engineer. Like, he's not playing the full four. He's saying he found that he just had to trim down some modest numbers of those. And let them be great when you draw them, but like don't flood out on them.
As a counterpoint to that, the Force cards in particular are interesting because you can pitch them to each other. And so sometimes in Legacy, like, I'll sideboard out like one Force of Will, and then I kind of wonder, like, what's the purpose of that? Like, if you draw two Forces, you can just use them to feed each other.
That's a good point. Got that Legacy brain. Got a big brain Legacy player here. So help us see the lights. Yeah, all right, I can see that.
But it might just be more that, like, Force of Virtue is a card we want to draw between 0 and 1 of a game. So, it's hard to say.
Well, I think it depends on, like, how important, like, producing creatures is to the game plan. And actually, like, I think you could build the deck like this with... You could even add more token makers to the deck. Like, you could add another Squadron Hawk to the deck. Like, there's Legion Conquistador.
There's a new version of that, too.
Yeah.
Or more realistically, there's Battle Screech from Modern Horizons. Battle Screech is an amazing card that's, I mean, we haven't talked about it yet, but I do think that that's one that is on power level for Modern. It's just that the token strategies have some puzzles to solve, and like, how are they going to actually not die to everything else that's happening in Modern? But if you can like craft a game plan that actually allows you to produce a bunch of tokens and then pump them, we should consider Battle Screech. And I think that this deck, the shell that you have here for us, Dave, because it gets to play actual discard spells, there might be something there.
Do we think that Force of Virtue is better than one of the classic Anthem effects? There's the one that gives all tokens +1/+1, and the one that gives all white creatures you control +1/+1.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, Force of Virtue buffing everything is very relevant, because it means like all your Squadron Hawks are getting buffed, or the Seasoned Pyromancer tokens are getting buffed. There's enough actual creatures that Force of Virtue buffing everything is very, I think, relevant.
And there's enough non-white creatures.
Right. Like all of Season Pyromancer.
Yeah.
It's just such a tempo positive play. Like, if you go first turn, discard spell, turn two, Squadron Hawk, on their turn, pitch Force of Virtue, turn three, play Season Pyromancer, like, that's a pretty sweet opening, and it's not like some crazy series of draws.
Yeah, I mean, the classic issue with the Anthem-type cards is that they're great when you have a nice board presence, and they're absolutely terrible if you're low on creatures in a game. And so the concept of exiling a creature to cast one is a little bit alarming to me. Like, it just, I worry that we will actually follow behind, even if it is tempo positive. If you have the Squadron Hawk line, I guess that seems pretty strong. But exiling either a Path or a Lingering Souls as the other white cards, yeah, we'll see.
There are certain matchups where Path is bad, right? Like, against blue-white, you don't mind pitching the Path. At least it just gives you a tempo positive way to, like, make your crappy little creatures a little bit more of a clock against blue-white.
The beauty of this deck is that it's a Faithless Looting deck, so any situation you can imagine where some card is bad, you just pitch it. Sorry, discard it. I need to get my verbs right. You discard it. So yeah, like maybe you don't have the right setup for a Force of Virtue, but you have Looting and Pyromancer to sort of flush the card and get a new one.
All right. Yeah, the old pitches to Looting argument. Yeah.
it can always get pitched to Collective Brutality when you go after their hand.
We can justify literally any card in this deck now.
You put Elesh Norn in here.
I think you just play like one of like Emrakul just so you beat mill decks or something. Like, why not?
Because Emrakul does not pitch to Force of Virtue, so we don't.
That's true. And also shuffling your own graveyard in is frequently a liability.
So I think this list is on the brink of something. What it's on the brink of remains to be determined, but yeah, I'm optimistic about this shell.
Yeah. Is there room for any of the new Yawgmoth? He showed up in the sixth place list.
Ooh, good call. Yeah, it's been a two of in some of these Mardu decks that we've seen for the past couple of weeks.
Yeah, the card absolutely can take over a game.
I think Yawgmoth can take Judith's spot.
It's a lot less aggro than Judith, but yeah, I mean, it does a different thing.
Yeah, I mean, this deck just still will never be an aggro deck.
That's true. That's a good point. We shouldn't trick ourselves into thinking we're ever going to be an aggro deck. That just never happens with these Mardu style decks.
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't actually know what the like best goldfish is, but it's not turn three, I don't think.
No, not even.
And I'm not sure it's turn four either.
No, I can't imagine it's turn four.
Well, I guess we'll find out in testing. So do you have another shell here that you want to talk us through, Dave?
Yeah, so I have a Esper's Skies list. This one takes advantage of the fact that Force of Virtue buffs all creatures. So you get to play a bunch of different cards. So you can play tokens, but unlike tokens list, you can play lots of non-token cards that also get buffed. So you still get to play your Squadron Hawk, which, as we've discussed, plays very well with Force of Virtue. But you can play Pride of Clouds, which gets +1/+1 for each other creature in play with flying. So it's sort of like a homeless man's Tarmogoyf.
What?
It's got long hairs growing out from living on the streets for a while.
A homeless Tarmogoyf?
It's a homeless man. It's worse than a poor man's Tarmogoyf. It's a homeless man's Tarmogoyf.
Okay.
Sorry, I got confused. I was thinking of an actual homeless Tarmogoyf.
A homeless man's Tarmogoyf. And then you can play some Disruption on your one drop. So Judge's Familiar and Mausoleum Wanderer are both cards that get buffed by Force of Virtue that would not get buffed if they were in like a normal token shell. And Mausoleum Wanderer having more power is very useful. So that's a reasonable interaction. And then a new card that I thought was interesting is the Empyrean Eagle, which is a M20 card. One, a white and a blue for a bird spirit. It's 2/3 flying, and other creatures you control with flying get +1/+1. So it's a spirit, so it pumps Mausoleum Wanderer, and it flies, so it triggers or it buffs Pride of Clouds, and it buffs other creatures. So it's sort of like an anthem slash something that also gains from an anthem.
Homeless Man's Drug School Captain.
Exactly. That's exactly right. But again, it buffs non-spirits, so it buffs your Judge's Familiar, it buffs all your Squadron Hawks, it buffs your Pride of Clouds or your Bitter Blossom tokens.
It's also a bird, so you get to say when you play it.
And Judge is Familiar.
The question that I would have for this deck, I like what's going on here, but Esper Skies, like, you're kind of losing me already when you say that phrase. Because when I hear Skies, I think, oh no, it's another favorable wins deck that Saffron Olive is probably playing on some MTG Goldfish video series and going 3-2 in the 2-man queues or something like that. So what we basically have here is we've replaced Favorable Winds with Force of Virtue and slightly changed up the flyer suite. But, I mean, the best flyers remain the same as they ever were. What's changed for the archetype? Is it that the Force of Virtue will allow you to be a little more tempo positive when you're trying to get a big squad? Or maybe this archetype was just underappreciated?
I'm not familiar with this archetype, I can't speak to the various Saffron Olive videos you watched.
It's not an archetype, sorry. It's a much like Aristocrats. It's something that people will say as if it will somehow become an archetype, but it never has been and perhaps never will be. And I'm just wondering if that's because there's like a fatal flaw to the plan.
I mean, there might be. The deck just doesn't have that much disruption, right? I mean, it's reasonable against other fair decks, like a lot of token generating decks often are, but what can you do if they're, you know, doing all the unfair things that modern decks are doing?
How does it compare to other like tribal-based decks with like lords in it? I mean, the closest deck would obviously be like the Spirits deck that actually has Spirit Lords and is all flying creatures. So if like if we line those up, like, we've got more creatures, so we go wider.
Yeah, they get to play the Counterspell Spirit, which is very, very important, I think, that we don't get to play.
When you say don't get to play, like, why don't you get to play it?
Well, I guess you could... It's not part of our primary plan, whereas they can play a card that has interaction that is part of their primary plan, because that's like really like a 4-5 for 3 or something that also has Hexproof. Like, without the Hexproof ability, I don't think Spellcaller is very good, which is why I typically don't include it on my flash list, even though Dan likes the card quite a bit. Our Mausoleum Wanderers aren't as buffed up as the Spirits list is. That also is a pretty big negative.
Well, the Wanderer is disruptive. And Judge's Familiar won back-to-back Pro Tours. One in a mono-blue deck and one in a mono-white deck. So there's that.
Yeah. I mean, I guess this deck isn't really meant to play at instant speed. It's more of a tap-out deck. So I can see how Spellcaller might not be quite as good. But, I mean, it's still a good card, even without Hexproof. I mean, a lot of games, Spirits does not have Darkhold Captain out at the same time.
Are there any disruptive cards that are on plan with this deck besides the Spellcaller?
Not that I'm aware of, other than if you choose to play the Queller. The other thing is you don't have to play Empyrean Eagle. There's a bunch of 4-mana Planeswalkers that Togan's decks often play that you could play. You can play the new Angel Sarah Planeswalker, who buffs all flying creatures and makes an angel herself. You can play either of the two 4-mana Sorins that buff all tokens or buff all creatures.
I like those.
Yeah, and those, I think those are a little higher power level than Empyrean Eagle. So maybe that's like the better kind of like value spot at the top of the curve.
Yeah, Sarah is an interesting card to me.
I don't even know what is her ultimate. Not that it matters.
That's a warship. No, it's super relevant in some matchups.
What does it cost to you to? What is her minus?
I believe you have to tick up once and then you can ultimate the next turn.
Oh really? Yeah. That's a lot more relevant than I would have thought. You're right.
So the plus is a Sarah Aviary for your team.
Minus is a Sarah Angel for your team. Yeah. The flavor for Sarah was just on point.
All right. Well, that's actually reasonable against some of the, if you have time, but that's somewhat disruptive against certain matchups.
Yeah. I think that the card Sarah, if it is it going to find any home in Modern, it would be like any deck that was considering playing Worship in the sideboard can play Sarah in the sideboard now because it's never dead. This deck might actually want a main deck.
Yeah, and Sarah is not sold out for your queue purposes. Readily available.
Yes.
1.35 ticks.
The low price.
That's interesting. I would be interested to try that card in this shell.
So I'm also wondering, maybe going in a different direction, you know, you have a pretty low curve, and the Force of Virtue being free would allow you to just get on the board as fast as possible, and I wonder if there's a way to do that with, like, loading up on the 1 and 2 slots. I'm trying to think of like what that would look like.
Memnite. Ornithopter, who knows?
I mean, Smuggler's Copter is a nice one with Squadron Hawk. You can pitch the extra hawks if you don't want
that. Oh, yeah, that's kind of interesting.
Pitch Lingering Souls if you don't want that. There's Fairy Seer in the one slots. Scry you to your good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of different ways you can go. This is just sort of an interesting sort of thought experiment, I would say.
Yeah, what the successful build looks like is still unknown based on past precedent. So there's a lot of cards we could try. I was thinking, actually, there's this new spirit from M20 that it's not very efficient. It's a 1-1 for 3 that makes a 1-1 token. But then it has a sac ability that is a Path to Exile for 4 mana, which is, again, not great. But we are interested in sort of spreading the bodies out across because of Pride of the Clouds and Force of Virtue. So as a 3-mana card, it's not that bad. And we may want the ability, I'm not sure. But you could do things like that that basically allow you to not have to play non-creature spells. You won't have to play Path to Exile because you can get that off your creatures.
Yeah, I mean, Hanging Executioner costing a total of 7 mana to get a path out of it. Seems like you may still want Path as Path.
But you see, what I'm saying is, what if instead of playing the best removal spell in the format, we play Hanged Executioner? Core 2020 is on sale from your local store next week.
The other thing you could consider doing is play a lot less removal and play like Hand Disruption on one, and then just assume you're going to have a bunch of like chump blockers, and then you'll, you know, whatever, win the race by the old-fashioned way.
Kitesail Freebooter is a disruptive flyer.
Yeah, I'm on board for that.
Well, there's a lot to tinker with here, and we may run out of tickets before we get to the bottom of it. But we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, I think we've said all we need to say.
So you were telling me, Dave, that you thought that the Soul Sisters archetype was a potential home for this sort of Squadron Hawk.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty boring, but I think that deck was already playing Spectral Procession and Squadron Hawk to turn on Martyr of Sands. And when you're doing that, you can play some amount of Spectral Procession very easily. The deck was already playing like Ranger of Eos, so the chances that you have a bunch of cheap creatures in play are pretty high. And again, that's a deck that could very easily main deck Rest in Peace, because you don't really rely on your graveyard for anything, especially if you kind of get rid of the, what's that, 2 and a white, return 3 1-drops to play a card.
Proclamation.
Yeah. If you just abandon Proclamation, then you don't need the graveyard for anything, and you can run Rest in Peace, which is a pretty sweet main deck card. And again, as we've said, in matchups where it doesn't matter, you can just pitch it to Force of Virtue. So yeah, then you just kind of turn all your little shit creatures, your Soul Warden and Soul's Attendants and things, into slightly less shit creatures.
I had to look up this archetype to see, like, is there actually an agreed upon most competitive build of Soul Sisters?
And?
Well, did you find the one with Norn the Wary?
Oh, yeah.
I think that one's probably the better performing one recently. I found an earlier version that did not have Norn the Wary, and it was playing 3 Honor of the Pure, so I think Force is like a nice upgrade there, potentially.
Yeah, it's a deck that can also play Windrisk Kites, which is kind of a sweet card to kind of like get some extra value. You know, Ranger of Eos is a kind of value card, so again, against fair decks, you've got some reasonable resources. We played a list that wasn't this list. It was a little bit more of a control-ish shell that wasn't focusing on sort of the life gain. And we were struggling against like full-on control decks because you kind of don't have the clock and you don't have the disruption to sort of compete. So you'd have to either punt that matchup or do something in the sideboard or something to compete.
So the conceptual difference between like the mono-white murder decks and the Soul Sister decks, they both have Murder of Sands and Sarah Ascendance, but the murder deck is a control deck. The Soul Sisters deck is an aggro deck, trying to play Johnny's Primate and attack with large creatures early.
Yeah, exactly.
So I mean, maybe that does shore up some of the weaknesses of that you were just talking about, where when the control martyr deck finds itself needing to pressure an opponent, it just can't do it. So now with Force of Virtue, you can. I don't know. I think Tom Ross wrote an article. So he's a longtime martyr fan, and he was on the development team. I think he might have been lead designer even for Horizons. This is one of the first cards that he wrote about was Force of Virtue.
Oh, really?
Star City column. Because he thinks it's really going to spruce up the mono white murder style decks in conjunction with Ranger Captain of Eos. So this card is in the set for a reason, the white force.
Person who was lead designer of a Hogak set.
He thinks Force of Virtue is the key card to be afraid of.
Yes, if you can read between the lines of his articles, you'll see that he just doesn't say much about Hogak. He says, let's wait and see how the meta shakes out. But, you know, I mean, it's a great set. I mean, let's be honest. This Modern Horizons is full of really interesting cards, and
that's
I don't want to put them on blast too much for one teensy-weensy. Who could have foreseen that a free 8/8 trample would be a problem? There was no way to know.
Yeah. And it does kind of give the metagame that's competing against Hogak now, if Hogak gets banned, it creates a whole new sort of like first week of a new Modern where everyone has to like kind of decide what the next deck that they're going to be targeting with their sideboards and main deck builds are in a post-Hogak world. So maybe they're just trying to like next level us and give us sort of two new formats.
I like that.
Who can dump the Ravenous Traps the fastest?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, on that note, any final thoughts on Force of Virtue?
It is a little better than Healing Self, and we're going to demonstrate that this week.
But Ancestral Recall is a lot better than Force of Negation.
Yes, I would agree with that as well.
Yeah, I mean, the card looks interesting. I'm excited to see, you know, how much of a place it has, how good this Anthem effect is. You know, does it make these decks able to close the door clockwise, you know, 2 turns faster, 1 turn faster? Is pitching a card a huge cost? We'll see.
Yeah, and if you're new to this podcast, you'll learn that when Damon says, this card looks interesting, what he means is, this looks wildly unplayable.
Well, try to be nice.
Yeah, no, those are like, apart from that, those are good analytical questions to pose for it. And I guess I'm wondering, like, are we going to find that our builds are actually sufficiently getting paid off for having the crusade in play, whether we pay zero mana or four mana for it. Like, do we have enough creatures to like really make us feel like this was worth putting in our deck? None of our builds that we have talked about so far are like full-on go-wide tokens, and like really there aren't any crusade type effects in modern, because there's just no strategy like that has proven successful. So,
well, I mean, the spirit, like the tribal cards, are all crusade effects, really.
I'm gonna retract my words. Yes, there has never been a just straight up enchantment crusade, but there are good crusades that are attached to creatures.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing that maybe they win with Benelish Marshal, is it's important to have the crusade be on a creature to make it be a strong card.
So yeah, I guess we'll find out and probably be tinkering with these lists as we go, and we'll let you know how that turned out next week.
Sounds like a plan.
Cool.
Let's see you then.
All right, take care, guys.
That'll do it for episode 9 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. All of the decks that we discussed today are posted in the show notes. That is to say, they are linked in the episode description of whichever app you use to listen to podcasts. You can also find us on the Modern subreddit at r/modernmagic and r/modernspikes. Faithless Brewing is a listener-supported show. If you liked what you heard today, please consider helping us out. We would really appreciate that. You can tell a friend, help us spread the word, leave us a review, and follow us on Twitter at FaithlessMTG. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.